sobering, stimulating, and hot. It's the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Program.
This is not about hate. This is not about anti-Semitism. It's about showing who is anti-Black. I didn't know what was in Michael's heart, but I told Michael, Michael, don't be angry with your father, because even though you didn't have pillow fights and sleepovers, those that had pillow fights and sleepovers and had a childhood, they're the ones that's buying your records and they're the ones that's coming to see you. You had a purpose for your life. You didn't know that Michael was a lecturer. I was surprised when I read Michael's lecture at Oxford University in England. See, Michael was much more than a man of song and dance. Michael was a heart that beat for the love of humanity. This is part of Michael Jackson's speech at Oxford. It's titled, Heal the Kids. It gives a view of MJ's philosophy and worldview better than any other source. And this is what Michael said at Oxford. Love, ladies and gentlemen, is the human family's most precious legacy, its richest bequest, its golden inheritance. And it is a treasure that is handed down from one generation to another. Previous ages may not have had the wealth we enjoy. Their houses may have lacked electricity, and they squeezed their many children into small homes without central heating, but those homes had no darkness, nor were they cold. They were lit bright with the glow of love, and they were warmed snugly by the very heat of the human heart. Parents, undistracted by the lust for luxury and status, accorded their children primacy in their lives. On the world condition, this is what brother said. Friends, let me paint a picture for you. Here's a typical day in America. Six youths under the age of 20 will commit suicide. 12 children under the age of 20 will die from firearms. Remember, this is a day, not a year. 399 children will be arrested for drug abuse. 1,352 babies will be born to teen mothers. This is happening in one of the richest, most developed countries in the history of the world. Here is Michael's goals. He said, our goal is simple, to recreate the parent-child bond, to renew its promise and light the way forward for all the beautiful children who are destined one day to walk this earth. They say that parenting is like dancing. You take one step, your child takes another. I have discovered that getting parents to rededicate themselves to their children is only half the story. The other half is preparing the children to re-accept their parents. Then he started talking about his father. He said he was talking about his father's father. He showed very little affection toward his family and raised my father and his siblings with an iron fist. Who could have imagined what it was like to grow up a poor black man in the South robbed of dignity, bereft of hope, struggling to become a man in a world that saw my father as subordinate. I was the first black artist to be played on MTV, and I remember how big a deal it was even then, and that was in the 80s. My father moved to Indiana and had a large family of his own, working long hours in the steel mills, work that kills the lungs and humbles the spirit, all to support his family. Is it any wonder that he found it difficult to expose his feelings? Is it any mystery that he hardened his heart, that he raised the emotional ramparts? And most of all, is it any wonder why he pushed his sons so hard to succeed as performers so that they could be saved from what he knew to be a life of indignity and poverty? I have begun to see that even my father's harshness was a kind of love, an imperfect love, be sure, but it was love nonetheless. He pushed me because he loved me, because he wanted no man to ever look down on his offspring. And now, with time, rather than bitterness, I feel blessing. In the place of anger, I have found absolution. And in the place of revenge, I have found reconciliation. And my initial fury has slowly given way to forgiveness. And that's what I'm asking all of us to do tonight. Live up to the fifth of the Ten Commandments. Honor your parents by not judging them. Give them the benefit of the doubt. That is why I want to forgive my father and to stop judging him. I want to forgive my father because I want a father, and this is the only one that I've got. I want the weight of my past lifted from my shoulders, and I want to be free to step into a new relationship with my father for the rest of my life, unhindered by the goblins of the past. In a world filled with hate, we must still dare to hope. In a world filled with anger, we must still dare to comfort. In a world filled with despair, we must still dare to dream. And in a world filled with distrust, we must still dare to believe. Michael Jackson. I'm almost finished. Can you be patient with me a little bit? I love this brother. And I feel a deep sense of personal loss. We had a quiet relationship. And he would call me on New Year's Day to wish me well and send me big bouquet of fruit in a huge bowl. And when we were close, I would say, I love you, Michael. He said, I love you more. And Michael wanted to fight the powers that were controlling him and trying to steal his legacy. Michael was a wise young man. When he bought for $35 million, I think it was, the master recordings of his own music and half of a 750,000 song catalog that includes music by the Beatles, Elvis Presley, Bob Dylan, the Staples Singers, Neil Diamond, and the Jonas Brothers. That means anytime they play any of those songs, he gets paid. That catalog that he had is worth more than $1 billion. And naturally, see, what you don't understand about the enemy, when they fear you, the first thing they must do is destroy your reputation, then destroy your wealth. And if you're still alive, we can have him then. Because he's no more, has no more money, he's a broken man, you can have him now. Look, Michael owned Little Richard's catalog. And according to our great brother, Dick Gregory, he said when Michael brought the rights to Little Richard, the architect of rock and roll, Michael returned to Little Richard the rights to his music free of charge. Now, I would like to tell you about Michael Jackson's money. See, knowing something about him just before he died, his final concert tour called This Is It, if you watch the short video of his talk and then what he was singing, Michael said, this is it. This was to be the end for him as a performer. Michael has written over 200 songs that have never been recorded. Michael, I watched him, you know, and the wise of the enemy, they watch him too. Michael said, this is it. I don't know what that means to you. But I know what it meant to me. And the enemy watching knows what it meant too. When he raised his fist, see, what you don't know, Michael is a warrior. And when he raised his fist, he was telling all the would-be's and the wannabe, my crown is like Michael Jordan's jersey. Nobody can wear my number when I finish. You hang it up. You put my crown on the shelf. Because it's the unreachable star. It's the unattainable goal. But I'm going to show the world that I am Michael Jackson. And I'm fighting for my legacy. This is it. And then when you watched him on the stage, see, he's in a militant. Looked like an FOI, you know. They didn't tell you what he was singing, but in the end, if you looked at his mouth, he said, they don't care about us.
Cedric Muhammad Black Coffee Program, July 30th, 2009, a Thursday. a Thursday. I had to make, what do you call this, a rain delay makeup? Shane from Houston says that Thursday is his favorite day. He likes that more than Saturday, Sunday, and Friday. I don't think I would move the show to Thursday. Business got to be right. By the way, if you want to advertise at blackelectric.com, Black Coffee Channel, CM Cap, if you want to promote an event, want me to wear your product, promote your service from my lips, or pre-recorded audio and video, we can do it all. Just fill out the partner with us form on the underneath the player on the CedricMuhammad.com site. Go to the show page. That's where you can put your comments too. You'll see a partner with us form, or you can send it to business@blackcoffeechannel.com, business@blackcoffeechannel.com, if you'd like to advertise. There is no mystery god, and I will not be asking for grant money to do this show, nor will I be asking activists when I get fired, because I can't get fired, to help me get my job back by protesting. No, I want business. I want to stay here because you value the audience. You have something to offer. You want to compensate me for giving you access to a wonderful network of entrepreneurs, artists, professionals, folks with demographic information that you would covet. Let's do it through business, trade and commerce, not grant money, not whacktivism, not shakedowns. I'm not interested in that. Let's do trade. Rod Ginyar, Culver City, California. He says, I'm late to the show, but I am here nonetheless. I just wanted to say that the minister needs only to add a beat to his words because he's very poetic and would make a very great rapper. Seriously, I don't know how he reaches so deep for his energy at his somewhat advanced age, but I'm thinking he's in some kind of an emotional zone that is extremely focused. His verbal cadence, along with the ebb and flow of his delivery, are uncanny. That's Rod Ginyard on Minister Farrakhan speaking about Michael Jackson. We just played 34 minutes of that audio, okay? Now you heard it. I think the whole message was over 2.5 hours. www.noi.org, www.finalcall.com for more information on that. Very powerful. I think all of us would, if we had to pick and we had common sense and we wanted someone to interpret us, I think we would pick the minister to speak on your behalf. Now, if I get arrested, it's Al Sharpton. Don't get it twisted. If I get arrested, thrown up on a police car, I'll let the minister handle other worldwide work. I'll call Reverend Sharpton for that. But on spiritual matters, on the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, among other things, on somebody to interpret the meaning of your life, who you gonna call? Minister Farrakhan. That's just my opinion. Now, and that's called, by the way, that's a division of labor. Reverend Sharpton handles, and by the way, Reverend Sharpton did a wonderful job at Michael Jackson's memorial service. Reverend Sharpton handles the activist work. Minister Farrakhan does something else. King J, Jorge Cornell does something else. Cynthia McKinney does another thing. I do my thing. I am being myself. I'm not conforming to stereotypes about what a black host is supposed to talk about. Nor am I being influenced by external forces who want to make me talk about something because they're paying the bills. This show will survive, or it will not survive, because I am doing business on its own merit and because I'm doing it with the group of people that I come from. So there's a universal opportunity to do trade and commerce with anyone who wants to advertise on this show. And then there's a group economic orientation for those who may find ethnic kinship with me, or a kindred spirit, I should say. No, I will not be replaying Minister Farrakhan's 34 minutes. If you missed it, you missed it. You just have to hear us commenting on it. Next hour, I want to get into a review of Tiny and Toya, as well as the T.O. show. I'm going to talk about the God particle, and I want to read this memo. Matter of fact, let me crack it open right now for all of you out there. I have a lot of weed smokers that listen to my show. I mean, let's just be clear. We did a whole show on the legalization or decriminalization of marijuana. Here is the memo from the Gangsters of the Week, also known as the managers of the residence in which I stay. I'm going to read this because this is my dilemma. If you have a dilemma, an ethical issue, you want me to offer my two cents, hopefully knowledge, wisdom, and understanding applied to your reality, send an email to dilemma@cedricmuhammad.com, dilemma@cedricmuhammad.com. I have a dilemma for you all. If you are a weed smoker, this is your time to shine. I need your insight. If you are not a weed smoker, I still need your insight. This is my dilemma to you. Here is the memo that I received in my residence last week. Quote, hold on, I need to get a visual. You all are not taking me seriously. This is a real dilemma. Let me give you a visual that fits the reality. Smoking weed, here we go. We have had several residents complaining about a strange odor coming through their vents. The smell is coming from a unit between the blank and blank floor, and the smell appears to be marijuana, which is illegal unless it was prescribed by a doctor. Please take into consideration that residents are affected by this smell and becoming ill. Please discontinue the use immediately, or we will have to report this to the authorities. Thank you for your understanding and cooperation. No lie. I'm serious as a heart attack. July 30th, 2009. I need your help. I'm going to read this again. This is the memo. It's, and by the way, the memo is called Strange Odor. No lie. Strange Odor. The name of the memo. Come on. Rod, California. Any of you weed smokers, you can use an alias. I'll permit it this time. I need you to dig down deep and give me some wisdom. I'm going to read this one more time. We have had several residents complaining about a strange odor coming through their vents in the apartments. The smell is coming from a unit between the blank and blank floor. The smell appears to be marijuana, which is illegal unless it was prescribed by a doctor. Please take into consideration that residents are affected by this smell and becoming ill. Please discontinue the use immediately, or we will have to report this to the authorities. Thank you for your understanding and cooperation. Come on, dig deep. I understand there's a lot of things going on in the world. We could talk about the stock market. We could talk about the healthcare battle taking place. We could talk about Skip Gates still. I'm going to get into why the album may or may not return. But let's talk about Strange Odor, the name of this memo. How gangster are the managers of the residence where I live? Because they are openly saying the smell appears to be marijuana. Please discontinue the use immediately, or we will have to report this to the authorities. How gangster is that? They didn't call the cops. What should I do? What would you do? A strange odor coming through the vents. And then they tell you, which I'm not going to say, they tell you what floors the smell is coming from. Almost like if you wanted to be a vigilante, they would approve of you going down there and handling the matter yourself. Let's talk about it. Those of you all who are in favor of decriminalization of weed, marijuana, cannabis, I need your insights. What would you do? I'm going to put the program on pause. I have this dilemma. I need your help. Come on. I'll give you a few more moments before we head into hour number four. Yeah, that's somebody smoking a blunt or something. I'm not an expert on this. I've never smoked weed in my life. I'm back from the West Coast. 114 degree heat I endured. It's ridiculous out there in the Southwest. Some comments coming in. What would you do if you got a memo like this in your condo or apartment? I may read it one more time. It says here, listen up. We have had several residents complaining about a strange odor. And again, the name of the memo is Strange Odor. We've had several residents complaining about a strange odor coming through their vents in the apartments. The smell is coming from a unit between the blank and blank floor. The smell appears to be marijuana, which is illegal unless it was prescribed by a doctor. Please take into consideration that residents are affected by this smell and becoming ill. Please discontinue the use immediately. I can hardly finish this. Please take into consideration that residents are affected by this smell and becoming ill. Please discontinue the use immediately, or we will have to report this to the authorities. Thank you for your understanding and cooperation. I'm asking you, what should I do? July 30th, 2009, a Thursday. We'll be back normal time on Wednesday. It's the hottest show in the diaspora. Get at me with any comments you have, any advice if you smoke weed or don't. I don't smoke weed, never have. I hear all of your arguments for decriminalization. What do you do when it's going on? You're in a state or a location where marijuana is not legal. I don't live in California where I think it's okay for medicinal purposes. You all can enlighten me on that. What should I do? I'll leave that out open for hour number four.
What is with that track? You still got
You know what? Hot Rob is, I'll explain it. At the time, I'm on Columbia Records. I got a release date coming. And there's no buzz surrounding the record. When you're in my situation, there's no plan B. You know, it's music or we sell crack. Because that's what we did before we did music. You understand what I mean? And in that environment, it may seem harsh, even when I say exactly what it is. You know, but that's what it is. That's what we did before we had the opportunity to do music. So it's a blessing. I am so happy to be where I'm at now that, you know, I would never, I would feel like I would be hustling backwards to go into doing something like that at this point. But at that particular time, that was what was provided for us to provide for ourselves in that environment. So that's what we did. And
Cedric Muhammad.
When you don't have an option, it absolutely has to work for you, you know? So I'm like, I gotta make a record that makes everybody stop right now and say, who's this guy 50 Cent? Right now, who's this guy, you know? And then the creative part, I got $65,000 in advance from Columbia. $50,000 went to Jam Master Jay to negotiate the release from JMJ Records. $10,000 went to the attorney that drew the contracts up between me and Columbia and the release from Jam Master Jay. It left me with $5,000, and I was out there for over a year before the record came out. So I was back selling crack. How else would I provide for myself and then be on call and able to be in the studio whenever the company called me to actually be there?
Cedric Muhammad.
You know, and at the end of that situation, it led back to Hot Rob. I'm like, you know, it doesn't matter to me, you know, if anyone's upset. You know, actually, it's in their best interest. I've had phone calls from people that you would think be upset, And now they're interested in doing music. You know, it's hilarious because I'm like, hell no.
Cedric Muhammad. Cedric Muhammad.
Paul could have said he'd been forsaken. He uses this, it's the same Greek word, deserted. So he was feeling this. He was feeling it very, very deeply down inside, that here he was coming to the end of his life. What had he done from the day he was saved on the Damascus Road? He had given himself to Jesus Christ, spending time in Arabia, letting God, getting his theology straightened out, having been an Old Testament scholar himself. And so he gave his life in doing what? Traveling the Mediterranean world of his day, establishing churches, establishing the churches, the people in Thessalonica and in Philippi and Corinth and Ephesus and all and many other little places. He spent his whole life. And in the 11th chapter of 2 Corinthians, he talked about how many times he was beaten and stoned and imprisoned and his concern for the churches. In other words, that little brief biographical sketch, you can think, how could any man survive all of that? And now here he is coming to the end of his life, and what? Nobody shows up. Nobody's there to support him. Nobody's there to bear testimony for him. Nobody's there to witness for him. What happened to all of these people who found Jesus really as a result of his work, whether it was personal one-on-one or whether it was a matter of finding Christ through one of those little churches, little groups of people? Where is friendship? What happens when people fail us? And what I want you to see here is this, that a man like the Apostle Paul was failed. That was, his friends failed to be reliable, failed to show up, failed to be supportive when he so desperately needed them. And the same thing can happen to us. People that you think are your friends, people that you have trusted in, people that you've given to, people that you've supported, people that you helped, prayed for, loved, and sometimes maybe sacrificed for, what happens? They can just walk off and desert you. Somebody says, well, it doesn't bother me. Yes, it does. It bothers all of us. And I can think about some times in my own life when I really needed somebody and needed some support and some help, what kind of support I got. So when I come to that, I think about the reasons people fail to be true, genuine friends. Why do they fail? Well, there are a number of reasons. You might want to jot some of these down and ask yourself the question, for example, if any of these fit you. And one of the reasons is that a person sometimes may feel inadequate. They want to help you in this difficult time, but they don't know how. So I can understand that sometimes that may be true, that a person doesn't know how to be the kind of friend to you that you need going through this time. Sometimes they don't want to be identified with you. And I've been through this in my life, and I remember when I first came to First Baptist and the church was calling me, we had this big battle and so forth, and it was in the newspapers and on it went, and it was all over, the pastors knew about it and so forth. This was a very interesting thing. In that battle, when I really needed someone to stand with me, two pastors wrote me a letter. One of them was not even a Southern Baptist pastor. He was an independent Baptist pastor here in Atlanta. And the other one was a pastor of the First Baptist Church in Jacksonville at that time. No one else. No one said, we're praying for you. No one said, we know you're going through a tough time. Nobody said a word. Not one single other person wrote me a letter or called me to say, we're standing with you. You know why? Because they didn't want to be identified. And here's the reason they didn't. I understand this. Because, well, suppose I lost, then they would have identified with a loser. What kind of friendship is that? And then I can remember a second time. And you would have thought pastors would have written me and my friends would have stood by me and all the rest and so forth. What did I get from fellow pastors, most of them, who made any comment at all? That is, well, why don't you quit the ministry? Why don't you do this? No support. I'm praying for it, none of that. In fact, it was amazing to me, but I learned something. I learned about how to respond. It was amazing to me how people got real quiet. They suspect you. In other words, people that you've been with and people that you've fellowshiped with and you've studied with and all the rest, silence. That is not friendship. You say, well, does it hurt? Well, sure it hurts. Anybody who says it doesn't, not telling the truth. For example, if your husband or your wife walked away from you, would it hurt? Yes. If your children walked away and said, you know, this is it, I don't want to be a part of this family, would that hurt you? Yes. And oftentimes it is our denial of hurt, our denial of pain, listen, that keeps us from being able to be healed of it. Two things, if you deny it, you won't be healed. And secondly, if you get bitter and unresentful, unforgiving, you won't be healed. And so this whole issue is a major thing. Then I think about other reasons, for example, and that is that sometimes people are jealous. And if they're jealous, they're not going to want to help you. Sometimes they're just selfish. They don't want to give you time. They don't want to take the time to give you a call. They don't want to take the time to say, well, let me tell you that I'm praying for you. In other words, where is friendship? Where is true, genuine, dedicated friendship? The Apostle Paul was going through the most difficult time in his life, and he said, everybody is gone, and as I look around, the only person I see is Luke, my favorite physician. Sometimes people, listen, when you go through a difficult time, you know what they do? Claim to be your friend, but instead of understanding you, they want to judge you. And they judge you, so that eliminates them having a responsibility to help you. It's all, listen to this. When people respond that way, the problem is they have a character flaw. Not in the person who's going through the difficulty, but in the person who claims to be a friend, but does not have the courage to stand with you, who does not have the love to be supportive and reliable and being there for you. And so the Apostle Paul was going through all of that. And if you think about all those years of his life, he invested in those men. He'd taken Demas, for example, on a missionary trip, and he checked out and got scared, and he left. And here he is at the end of his life, second time he's before a trial, nobody. In fact, before, when he was in the first trial, some of those pastors on the outside, they were being critical of him instead of standing there being supportive of him. I don't know who your friends are, but if you're a genuine friend, you're a true friend, reliability, being there, helping them and supporting them and praying for them and undergirding them and loving them, that's what friendship's about. If you don't have any of that in your life, you're not a friend no matter who you are. And oftentimes people who claim to be our friends want something. That is not friendship. That's not friendship. If that's the motivation. If they want to give something, that's friendship. You know what happens when you give? You receive in return. And so oftentimes we are very, very hurt and pained because of those things. Now, second thing I want to say is that forgiveness is absolutely necessary. Forgiveness is absolutely necessary and must prevail in spite of our hurts. Now, his friends deserted him. But it's interesting what the Apostle Paul said. Because as you look at what happened and feeling the pain and so forth, all the things, in other words, he could have said, you know what, that bunch of scoundrels, they didn't, you know, he didn't say any of that. But here he is in the most difficult moment of his life, and he's standing alone. Now, let's put it this way. If you've grown up in a family with lots of kids, then you know what fellowship's all about. I mean, you may have had fights and so forth, but at least they were there. And one thing about families like that, they may fight with each other, but you better not mess with one of them because there's something there that's beyond everything else. And so here's the Apostle Paul. He's all by himself, all alone. Aloneness can be very, very painful. Aloneness can be traumatic in a person's life, and especially when they're facing death. So what's the right response? Well, when I look at this passage and see what he said, I want you to turn, look at that 16th verse again in the fourth chapter. Listen to what Paul said. He said, at my defense, no one supported me, but all deserted me. May it not be counted against them. Now, what do you think he got that? What did Jesus say to his persecutors? What did he say? Father, what? Forgive them, for they know not what they do. But I'll tell you, he may have remembered that. But this I know he remembered, absolutely. Because it was Saul of Tarsus, Paul, who became the apostle, who stood by and watched over the cloaks of the men who stoned Stephen to death. And the last thing Stephen said is, Father, forgive them. They don't understand what they're doing. And now here is the Apostle Paul. And his friends have deserted him. So what is he doing? Here's what he's doing. He's practicing what he preached. And he's able to forgive them. If you hold unforgiveness towards someone who mistreats you, then there's no healing of that. And it's very evident here what he says. He says, I'm not going to hold it against them. In other words, and he says to Timothy, don't count it against them. Now, sometimes we might be prone to say, well, I'll tell you one thing. If you ever need me, don't call on me. Because that is an unforgiving spirit. And here's what I've noticed. Oftentimes, when a friend betrays you or deserts you for some reason, sooner or later, mark this down, they need you. So what are you to say? Well, I've been waiting for this to happen. No, that's not what you say. I knew it was going to happen. It's my turn to get them back. I'm going to show them what it's all about. No. Paul said, I'm not going to hold it against them. Because it's not a godly thing to do. And think about this. In your lifetime, how many true, genuine friends do you have? And if I said, count them on both hands and all toes, true, genuine friends that'll stand by you, thick and thin. And somebody says, well, thick and thin, when it gets too thick, we thin out. And that's exactly how some people are. That is, if things are just not like they ought to be, and you see, you got fair weather friends. Watch this. As long as you've got money, you have people who tell you they're your friend. As long as you're popular, you got friends. And as long as so many other things are true. The truth is, what about when you're just you? You see, I think about people who are very, very, very wealthy. They don't know who their friends are. I mean, they may finally find out who a few of them may be. But people who have much have to be very careful because there's always somebody out there If you're real, you're real. If you're true, you're true. And if you're who you are, then you're who you are today. You're on Sunday, Monday through Saturday. I mean, it doesn't make any sense who you're talking to, where you are. If we're truly genuine, we're just who we are. We aren't one thing today and something else to somebody else, but we're just who we are. And the Apostle Paul was who he was, and obedient to God. And what happened? Here's prison and facing death, and nobody's there.
All right, family. July 30th, 2009. Cedric Muhammad Black Coffee Program. I got somebody on the line. Hello, sir, are you there?
Yes.
Hold on. Easy. Hold on. Pump the brakes. I don't want you a superstar. I want to bring you on right. Hold on. Let me put the music on.
Okay.
My brother, this is everybody. This is Nimba. The great Nimba from Ivory Coast has called in. How you doing, bro?
I'm doing excellent. And you?
I'm good. Thank you, man. I'm so happy to finally put a voice to your magnificent post. You have now taken me into a new zone with this new music. What am I listening to?
Okay, this is the Coupe de Calais.
Coupe de Calais. So I was pronouncing it wrong.
Yeah, Coupe de Calais. Apple Coupe de Calais is a French word. But when you turn in the Ivorian jargon, we speak actually in Côte d'Ivoire, we have our own French. It's like a French Creole. It's the only French Creole spoken in Africa, and it's called Nushi. So when you try to translate coupé décalé, coupé means first in French to cut, and décalé means to take off. Now, when you translate the coupé décalé in the Ivorian jargon, means cut and run. So coupé décalé, yes.
So this is a Creole. Explain that. Say that again one more time.
I was saying, coupé décalé is a French word. Coupé décalé. It's called coupé décalé. And we try to translate this word in Nushi. Nushi is a French street. It's a French street. Most young people use Nushi to speak. So it's like a street French.
And this music, coupé décalé, started when? Give me the history on it.
Okay. Atto Coupé de Calais was created by the late Duke Saga. And Duke Saga passed away in 2007. So Coupé de Calais was created in 2001 during the crisis in Côte d'Ivoire. For everybody, I have to remind everybody that Côte d'Ivoire is a country located in West Africa, and we speak French because we have been quote-unquote colonized by French. So we are a farmer, French colony. And Côte d'Ivoire has always been repeated by for its peaceful and also the hospitality of the Ivorian people. So we have been a little bit in crisis since the death of the first president of Côte d'Ivoire. His name was Félix Houphouët-Boigny, and he passed away in 1993. So after his death, in the political arena, many people were trying to take his place fighting. I'm just giving you, a brief history of Côte d'Ivoire, why those things happened until 2002.
Okay, now you're giving me the history of Côte d'Ivoire, also known as the Ivory Coast, from when?
Yeah, Côte d'Ivoire. Côte d'Ivoire is actually the official name of Ivory Coast. But most people don't know that the real name of Côte d'Ivoire is Ebony, E-B-U-R-N-Y.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the word comes from, Ebony. And Ebony means the land of black people. The land of black people, Ebony. But we say Côte d'Ivoire, La République de Côte d'Ivoire, or Ivory Coast. And the political people of Côte d'Ivoire, they say we don't want to translate Côte d'Ivoire in any language.
Right, that's why you don't like it when people say Ivory Coast, right?
Yes, we don't like that. We just say Côte d'Ivoire, La Côte d'Ivoire, exactly. So, in 2002, that's where the Coupé de Calais was created by Duke Saga. So he was it is a song just to not only for party, yes, of course, for happiness, but at the same time, Coupé de Calais is also a conscientious music. You see, we talk about what's going on every day in life of Ivorian people, not only the Ivorian people, but also the African people. Like we talk about politics, I mean, the daily life, you know, social problem, the problem, you know, like people facing every day by day, you know, but we just turn this in music, because to express something, you have to turn, you know, music so people can, you know, can feel it. So that's why, I mean, Coupé de Calais was created by Duke Saga. And it's good for us, the G-Set. So actually, the member of the G-Set, I think I sent you some more videos. Also, now, the member of the G-Set is a group created by Duke Saga, the creator of the Coupé de Calais music. So now the G-Set group has been, dismantled. So everybody is not taking away to sing, you know, for themselves. So this is where the Coupé de Calais came from in 2002, during the crisis in Côte d'Ivoire, when French government and army was backing the rebels to try to overthrow the elected president called Laurent Gbagbo. He's not the actual president of Côte d'Ivoire. His name is Laurent Gbagbo, and he's one of the greatest African leaders.
Okay, now help me out, Nimba, because, you know, I'm real boldly ignorant. So when I see my friends from the Ivory Coast,
yes,
all around Washington, D.C., or I'm talking to them, I say Gbagbo. What, the G is silent?
Yeah, the G is silent. We say Gbagbo.
Okay, Gbagbo, okay.
Yes, Gbagbo, Laurent Gbagbo. Laurent Gbagbo. Laurent Gbagbo is also a high intellectual person. He's a farmer, professor of university in the University of Abidjan. And Laurent Gbagbo has been a political, you know, figure in Côte d'Ivoire. And he was the only one who refused to be backed down by the late President Félix Kouani, who tried everything, you know, to eliminate him politically. And Laurent Gbagbo was a guy who was really focused, he was believing in himself. He wanted to change Côte d'Ivoire. So in 2002, after the presidential election in Côte d'Ivoire, he won the election. In 2002, Mr. Laurent Gbagbo came to power. Okay? And because in Côte d'Ivoire, every 5 years, we have presidential election. Every 5 years. And the coming on November, the 29th of November 2009, we will be having a new presidential election. So Côte d'Ivoire is a very open country. It's a free country in terms of free of expression and everything. And Côte d'Ivoire is a very peaceful country. So we don't have to, you know, to believe Côte d'Ivoire yet we have a war. No, it's a peaceful country. And the Ivorian people are really people that really open. And France has, I think everybody might think that France, you know, is a country and everybody loves France. But there are a lot of things people don't know about France. France is one of the countries the most racist in the world. If you remember, in 2006, during the riot in Paris, I think everybody might remember this. The crisis in France happened in 2006 was the fact that black people in France and people from North Africa, like Morocco, Algeria, they have a huge community in France. And the black people from West Africa and also the people from North Africa have been always racial profiling. The police, sometimes in Paris, when you're black and you walk, the police can just arrest you because for your skin of color. So French is not really a country, you know, that people might think that, you know, is, of course, you know, people like to talk about French. I'm going to Paris to shop, yes. But there are a lot of hiding things about French that a lot of people don't know there. But anyway, just to give you a little bit, you know, the image of France.
Yeah, teach on France.
Yes.
Go ahead. No, I mean, I want to bring it raw. I mean, you live in the Ivory Coast. Your family's from there. You do business there. What is the bottom line view of the people of Cote d'Ivoire towards France? Is it a friendly relationship? Is it contentious? What goes on?
Okay. We see. The relationship between France and Cote d'Ivoire went down in 2002 when France, the country, was supporting the rebels to take over the government of Cote d'Ivoire. That's where the relationship just went down. Because in 2002, when the rebels took the north side of Cote d'Ivoire, because the rebels, they failed, you know, a coup d'etat against President Gbagbo. And everybody knew that the rebel was backed by France.
Okay, so it was a coup, a rebellion backed by France. Okay.
Yeah, by France. Yeah, in 2002. So in 2002, the army of Cote d'Ivoire, called FANCI, army of Cote d'Ivoire, decide to go defend or to go take over the rebel. So we the government of Cote d'Ivoire and the rebel, the army of Cote d'Ivoire went against the rebel. But at the same time, we didn't know that the rebel was financed, you know, like material, heavy thing by France.
All the equipment, the military equipment, yeah, was coming from France?
Yeah, from France, okay? So when the army of Cote d'Ivoire, you know, went to take over the territory held by rebels, after two days of fight, when France see that, you know, the government of Cote d'Ivoire was taking over the rebels, okay, so the army of France that were already in place, you know, to so-called, you know, to break, you know, the war between the two armies. When the army of France see that, you know, the government of Cote d'Ivoire was taking over, at the same time, France came to destroy all our equipment. And that raised, you know, the anger of Cote d'Ivoire, of people of Cote d'Ivoire. That's where in 2000, between France and Cote d'Ivoire, we become so-called enemies. But right now, you know, we have a peaceful, you know, situation now going on now, and our people, you know, people are now come together, have one.
Okay, now, you know, I want to thank you for the geopolitical move. You know, the show is about geopolitics, economics, music, and motivation. Let's move from geopolitics now to economics and motivation. Let's talk about you. You're an entrepreneur. Tell me how you get down, Nimba.
Nimba is actually I come to the United States first to go to school. I mean, my mom, you know, I have a degree in international, you know, business, you know. And also, I'm an entrepreneur, a young African, you know, entrepreneur. I'm the CEO and the founder of the Nimba Clothing Line. Nimba Clothing Line is a unique, stylish, you know, design made in Cote d'Ivoire by Cote d'Ivoire designer and for the Black diaspora. I mean, I'm not trying to explain everybody, you know, but you know, the way it is, you know. So I formed the Nimba Clothing Line in 2006, you know. So I'm trying to bring, you know, like a new, you know, way of fashion, you know, in the mainstream, you know, because the Nimba Clothing Line is a very symbolic design.
Now Nimba, where can everybody find more information about your clothing line on the internet?
Okay, for now, visually I haven't yet, you know, we're working, you know, I'm trying to build, you know, the website first. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just started, you know. So
Now, Nimba, hold on, brother. Easy now. Wait, what's this pageant that you were trying to get me in, this African pageant? We'll be right back. CedricMuhammad.com.
Cedric Muhammad.